Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 62 of Registry Matters. Happy Saturday to you, Larry. How are you?
Thank you, Andy. I'm just having a wonderful Saturday. It's been fun, delightful day.
And thank you for coming back.
Coming back? Where did I go?
Well, thank you for coming back and joining me again.
Oh, well, it's my pleasure always to join you. I just love hearing your dynamic voice.
What should we talk about before we go into the show? What words of wisdom, what sort of fun stories might you have?
I don't have any words of wisdom. Let's get this thing rolling. I'm so far behind, I'm never going to catch up anyway.
So we received a couple messages. We got, like, I think, 10 articles to cover. And so this one came in off of the website, and this comes from Jimmy. And he has a question. It says, I was convicted in the state of Kentucky in 1992, sentenced to 20 years. At that time, there was no sex offender registry in existence. Therefore, no registry requirements contained in the judgment. I was released on parole in 2002 and placed on the registry as a requirement of my parole for life. I was violated and returned to prison and thereafter served out my sentence until 12-1-2005, again, as a lifetime registrant. How could this not be a retroactive application of the law in my particular situation? Am I correct in my thinking that this is, in fact, an ex post facto violation? What can I do to correct this? Please help me. What is your opinion of Jimmy's situation?
Well, I love the succinct nature of the question. We need good questions like that. He's right that it is an ex post facto application of the law. Where it gets a little bit murky is because there's no prohibition against ex post facto unless it's a punishment aspect. Civil laws can be changed without running afoul of the ex post facto clause of the U.S. Constitution. And so there was no registry in 92, so the court in 92 would not have been able to apprise him of a duty to register that didn't exist. So far, so good. When he gets out of prison, there is a registry requirement, so that had been imposed, and he was apprised before the paroling authorities. I'm assuming that he had some supervision tail because he says he was revoked. So as a condition of being in compliance with parole, you have to be in compliance with all state and federal local laws. So if they tell him there's a registration obligation that's been imposed and you need to comply with it. And so where it gets dicier is, if he would listen to last week's episode, if he hasn't, is where it becomes problematic is when the registry has been found by a court to impose punishment. When it transcends those boundaries of the Kennedy-Mendoza-Martinez test that we talked about in the last episode, then you've got a problem. Now, we all know that almost every registry in the country, certainly more than a majority, more than half of them, are beyond the point where they could be considered civil. But just because we know it's punishment doesn't mean that we've proven that. We've shown by the clearest of proof to a receptive judicial tribunal that wants to hear it. And until that happens, they can change the registry, and they've done that all across the country. People thought they had tenure. Ask the good folks in Wyoming what they thought they had. Ask the good folks in Nebraska. Ask the good folks in Ohio. The good folks in Indiana. The good folks in Maryland. I mean, on and on and on. The New York state. I mean, California. No, California was always left, has been for a long time, but Florida, Alabama. I mean, I can go on and on with registry requirements that have been increased. Just merely extending the time that you're required to register something doesn't in and of itself make that requirement punitive. If they change their 10-year obligation to simply mail a form in and they said you got to mail this form in for 15 years, you could go about your life and do what you want to, live where you want to, visit where you want to, but you just have to mail the form in once a year for 15 years. It would be difficult to argue and convince a tribunal that that's punishment. You have to mail your car registration in about once a year in most states, as far as I know.
So somewhere that's the disability, imposes significant disability restraints, correct?
Well, to me, that's one of the most critical parts of, right. of that seven. There's seven factors, though. But to me, when If the court says, and lawyers have rolling their eyes when I tell them this, if the court says we're upholding this because it doesn't impose any disabilities or restraints, an offender is free to live and work where they want to and travel at will, it seems logical to me that if it's doing those things that the court said it's constitutional because it doesn't do these things, it only seems rational that once it's doing those things, that that would be very problematic because that was the basis which the court said it was okay because it doesn't do these things. To me, it's not a big leap to make that if it's doing those things, it has now transformed from what was relatively benign to something that's very restrictive. And that's where you run into the problem. When you commit a crime, you're supposed to know what your punishment is going to be. It can't be altered. But meddling in a form, arguably, is not a whole lot of, that's not that much punishment is sending in a form. But when you have to mail in the form every 3 months and you have to go in person, I mean, not mail in the form, but you have to go in person every 3 months and you have to pay a big fee and you're restricted to where you can live and you're
And
restricted to the
work.
type of jobs you can hold,
Right.
then you have a whole lot more disabilities and restraints to argue about that they didn't have back in 2003 when the court looked at the Alaska scheme at that time.
I gotcha. Do you want to move on to the next? Are you ready?
Well, Jimmy wants to know what can be done about this, and the answer is as bad as it sounds, is that it's going to require additional litigation. I believe Kentucky falls within the Sixth Circuit. We've got the favorable decision out of the Sixth Circuit, Doe's versus Snyder, so it's going to require some litigation, well put together litigation, well funded litigation, because the state is not going to concede that their registry is punitive. They're going to argue whatever difference they can find between the Michigan scheme and what they have in Kentucky. They're going to say, well, they do that in Michigan. We don't do this here. So, therefore, so you Kentuckians, you need to be prepared. And NARSOL is always receptive to good litigation in terms of. Sharing our limited resources, we're receptive to hearing good causes of litigation. But unfortunately, the offenders are going to have to pony up and do a well-funded, well-prepared case and quit doing this on the cheap and hoping that the public defender can do it through a criminal case. We need to do a declaratory action where evidence is brought in, experts is brought in to testify about the punitive aspects of the registry. That's the way it's done correctly. I just confirmed Kentucky is in six. I thought my recollection was they are there. So.
Jeff has told us that because Jeff, part of his question sequence has been about the Sixth Circuit. This comes from a person named Matthew, left a comment on the website. He says, these podcasts are educational, but I have to ask why it ends there. Why does NARSOL and its sister groups want to keep registrants divided, isolated, and powerless? Nothing ever changes until groups are able to unite, coming together under a common cause with all their voices being heard. Yet NARSOL only desires to be the only voice heard or the voices of their hand-picked guys. I see y'all fighting for registration to end for minor offenses, but too scared to denounce the inhumane punishment for most others. Excuse me, I'm not funded by no telling how many thousands of dollars, and I have no desire to control the narrative. I am one man that got tired of us being a divided, hated group with no voice, getting told the public isn't ready for us to be treated as humans, similar to the Jews and African Americans 60 years ago. No more excuses. We need to come together and stop this insanity. Galissa's website, I foot the bill, no one helps me with it, and I no longer ask because they didn't care to respond. It's made for one reason, for us to come together and not be forced into silence by fear of further humiliation. We can overcome these things, but we have to do it together. Everyone deserves a voice. Our voices are our power to end this treatment we get. One of the things that I said in the response to Matthew was like, do not make the distinction that this podcast is NARSOL. Or excuse me, don't confuse that this isn't that this is in NARSOL. I mean, we both volunteer for them, we both work for them, but this is an independent production, so don't lump Registry Matters in with any other organization and what we are trying to do. I'm pretty sure that Larry and I speak from the same point of view that you could make a constitutional registry. However, the registry as it is, it's ineffective, it's unconstitutional, and shouldn't be there. That is the message that we're trying to relay. How we get there, that's an entirely that's a discussion for each specific case along the way. But I just wanted to bring that up, and like I said, if we want to drop it from the show, we can. But I wanted to make sure that that got addressed again because this has come up before, that we shouldn't be saying NARSOL believes this or that. We are not saying NARSOL believes this or that. We are independent of that.
Well, I find this exchange very, very disturbing because nothing could be further from the truth in what he says. And why does Narsil and its sister groups want to keep registrants divided? I can't speak for the sister groups, divided, isolated, and powerless. That is just so ridiculous. I mean, it's absurd. I don't know what would possess a person to say such a thing.
I know of one advocate that is in favor of some form of registry, and it's not an illogical reasoning behind why she wants to have some kind of registry. But that said, that's the only person that I know of that is in favor of some kind of registry. Everybody else is interested in some level of total abolishment. But is that practical is a conversation that we have on a regular basis.
But to this point of like, I can't speak for other organizations, but I know that Narsil doesn't want to keep registrants divided, isolated, and powerless. We do just the opposite. We try to empower, we try to unite registrants. What he's saying is just so distant from the truth. And then yet Narsil desires to be the only voice heard, really, by their handpicked guys. Our organization, Narsil, which I am on the board of directors, we are the only organization that allows for input in terms of who gets to be on the board of directors. And in fact, this year it's going to be even more open. It's already been very open where the affiliates have chosen 2/3 of our directors. And it's going to be even more open in the coming process where the members themselves will actually choose who's on the board of directors after they've gone through a screening process to make sure they possess the requisite skills to serve on the board of directors, which all organizations, all businesses do that. But Narsil does not try to keep people silent. They do not try to do what he says. I resent that. It's just so untrue. I don't know who the person is, but whoever it is totally misinformed. And it sounds like they almost have an axe to grind against Narsil.
It does sound roughly like that.
In terms of the registry, I don't know who he's talking about. It's not us. We don't say we support any type of registry.
Right.
What we're talking about is what, let me diagram this carefully for whoever this is. There's things that you don't like that are not unconstitutional. Just because you don't like something, that does not magically make what you don't like unconstitutional. And if you're going to try to solve something with the courts, you have to only bring things to the courts that are unconstitutional because the courts are not super legislators. They are the interpreters of what the people have done through the elected process. And a registry could be created that would not inflict any punishment and would be very constitutional. That's a separate question to whether or not it would be effective and would it be wise public policy. If you don't like a public policy, that doesn't make that policy unconstitutional. And people somehow don't understand that. I don't like the fact that marijuana is as highly regulated as it is. That doesn't make the regulation of marijuana unconstitutional.
Right.
Does it?
No.
So the registration, in and of itself, the mere act of registering a person through a process is not unconstitutional. And somehow or another that gets translated into I'm for registries.
Right.
No, I am not for registries. I'm telling you, if you want to make constitutional arguments, you can't win on that one. You have to argue that each registry individually has to be analyzed to figure out if it is punitive, because you can register people in non-punitive processes. Hopefully, the day will come that any type of public registration will be deemed punitive. But we've got to convince the courts that we can show evidence that merely putting a person's information on the internet is punitive. We're not there yet. We are not. There's big businesses making gobs and gobs of money collecting publicly funded records that are open to the public, and they're putting them online and they're selling them and making a fortune. And that's where we're up against. They're not going to want to give up their graveyard. What is that? MyLife.com?
Yes.
One of them.
Right.
Yes. They make gobs of money doing that. And they're going to holler First Amendment and everything else, that they have the right to do this, and these records are public. But like I said, the person is so misinformed about what Narsil is. I think he's got an axe to grind. And, but it's just untrue, and I'm sad to hear that, because we're not trying to silence people. I heard a criticism about the Tenth Circuit case on the driver's license marking.
Okay.
And the name of the case is escaping me. And in our amicus brief, we said that they could have more narrowly tailored it. Well, but that that has to be a legal argument that you make, because some things that are not permissible can be permissible if they're narrowly tailored. So as from a legal point, you can't say that there's no it's not permissible to ever mark a document. That's an absurd, ridiculous argument. We right. mark documents all the time. We sure. mark documents all the time that the government issues. So simply saying that marking a document is unconstitutional, that is ridiculous to say. So you have to concede to the court, if you're going to have credibility as an attorney, that there are markings that would be acceptable. It depends on whether they are narrowly tailored to a specific situation that would be within the realm of acceptability and what the marking is. But they said, well, you shouldn't have even conceded. But yeah, well, if you don't want to be considered a credible attorney, you just go ahead. I'll tell you what you do. You show us how it's done, and we'll quickly follow after you.
Right. And I knew that. I knew that was coming as part. I mean, one of the reasons why I wanted to bring this up is here is yet another person saying, we will do it my way. And I know that you would have a freaking caravan of people following you if you figured out the way to do it in your state, which I don't know which state that is. But if you figured out how to do it in your state, then we would have 49 other states that would try and figure out how to replicate what you're doing. But there again, it's not something that we can just bring the whole thing down in one fell swoop. We would still have 50 or 51 if DC has one, and maybe the territories have their own. So, you know, we've got 50, whatever, let's call it 60 registries that we'd have to go fight.
Well, but that's not what the people that are living this horror want to hear. They want to think that there's a mm-hmm. magic bullet out there that will end the registry. There is no magic bullet. If there were, we would fire that magic bullet. We don't right. want any additional days of suffering. But there isn't a magic bullet. There isn't. It's like the death penalty. Even that has not been a magic bullet.
Right.
People have been trying to abolish the death penalty for how many decades now? I mean, the United States is the last civilized country on planet Earth to be putting people to death.
Yes.
And it's been a slow evolutionary process to get this country to where as many states have abolished it has. And I can't give the exact count, but it has been an incremental thing. We quit executing juveniles. We quit executing people with mental disabilities. There's debate now about how physically disabled and incapacitated a person is before they wouldn't be eligible for capital punishment. It's not magic to abolish bad public policy. It's not magic. We have to do that with who we elect. And I got a suggestion for you that wrote this. Why don't you quit voting for the wrong people? That would go a long ways.
The only level of sympathy to support this person's comments is that, you know, we've been doing this podcast for 17, 16 months or so. And even still, my advocacy started with Narsol in, I think, 2015. I've just like reading and trying to figure out and understand what's going on, of how much my thought processes have changed talking to you, talking to others, listening to the various phone calls, going to the conferences and so forth, of, you know, there's this whole foundation of like, well, it shouldn't be this way, but that's not how you make it change. Fine, it shouldn't be. But this whole thing is a massive education process too. And I can only then speak for myself to say that this is a massive learning curve to try and learn how these things are in place and what it takes to change them and what is legit, what could be gotten away with, what might not be. So I do sympathize with the individual just a little bit, but it seems like he's coming after us to some degree and coming after the various advocacy groups with a certain level of misinformation too.
Well, I agree with him on one thing for sure. And a lot of people can't even agree on this point. The registry is the problem. If we didn't register people for sexual offenses, we wouldn't have all these extra things that they do. The registry is the evil. The fact that we label people with this and we put them in this category. If we can get rid of the registry, life is going to get a whole lot better. That wouldn't be the cure-all, end-all, because we would still have the fact that public conviction records live on and on and on with
right.
like My Life and all these places out there where you can find people's history at the click of a mouse. But it's the beginning. We're doing a lot of incremental steps. We've got an expungement bill in our legislature this year. It's actually, in all likelihood, going to pass, probably not in the exact same form it was introduced in. And we don't have the right-wing fanatic governor prosecutor that's going to veto it. If we can get it to the finish line this year, there's a good chance we'll get a signature from the governor, which will help address the problem of the records, because that will take a lot of records outside the purview of the prying eyes, particularly those that didn't result in a conviction, but even those that did result in conviction after a specified amount of years. But the registry is a big part of the problem. A lot of people will hire felons, but they won't hire a person on a registry.
Correct.
Their patience goes away when it comes to a registry. Well, yes, we're very, very good about hiring felons, but not that kind of felon.
Yeah, not that kind.
So I agree with him that the registry is the problem.
Sure. And
there's no silver bullet.
Right. Well, okay. So we covered that for like 10 or so minutes. I just wanted to make sure that air got cleared, because that one that bothered me this morning when I was sitting at Starbucks reading stuff. And then moving on, we got an email message from Mike at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. He says, "Hello, what I wanted to know is these registry laws were made because they thought the recidivism rate was 80%. And since the person who did the study has since retracted his study and has done another study, and his new study shows the recidivism rate is under 5%, and every single state in the U.S. has done a study on recidivism, and the U.S. government has done a study, and every single study has shown the recidivism rate is under 5%. And I mean every single study is under 5%. So that being the case, why not go after all of that and get the registry taken down? And that recidivism rate is lower than any other crime. So why are we walking on eggshells to get this done? The government doesn't want this to happen because every person on the registry can sue in every state they live in. So I hope you redirect your focus in this direction, because if you don't, I'm going to put together a group to collect all of these studies and blast it in the media and the government. I hope you do go in this direction, and if you do, I would like to join the cause. Thank you." It's a lot of studies.
Well, it's I don't even know where to start. The studies people do, it's not a big part of my argument. I don't go there, but I'm just a mere one little mortal who advocates in this arena. I just use my experience of he's right that the recidivism is not anywhere near what it was once thought to be. And policymakers often now know that the recidivism rate is far lower, and that 3-5% is commonly known. But I keep telling you, why don't you run the length of a football field? Let me put 100 bullets in there, and only three of them are live rounds. Would you let me shoot it at you?
Absolutely, bring it. I can run.
Yeah,
I can dodge it.
It's just not a powerful argument. I have not had anyone say, "Oh, well, yes. Now that it's only three of the people out of 100 is going to do a sex offense. Well, of course we won't abolish the registry. Why didn't I think of that?" That's
right.
Not the reaction you get. The reaction you get is, well, it's lower than what we thought, but still these crimes are so serious and so heinous and so horrible that if it saves one, it's worth it. That's what they will say. This is not what Larry's saying. This is what they say.
Right.
And so the statistics don't win you over. And then you'll have that's one of the most common ones. The other one is sex offenses are so vastly underreported. The Me Too movement will tell you that we're only capturing a tip of the iceberg of the sex offenders that are out there. They're being committed, and how many sex offenders ought to be in the system. And if we had more reporting, we would have different, that a lot of the recidivism is just going unreported. I welcome him with all sincerity to take those studies, to go to whatever capital he's in, make those arguments, and if they work, we'll quickly follow right behind you and do the same thing. It hasn't proven to work for me. I have not had anybody have any traction on saying that they can get anybody who wants to sponsor an abolition of the registry because recidivism's low. So the offer I commonly make is, if you show us how it's done, we'll quickly follow suit.
I'm with you. And then, I mean, you know, then he also brings up the sue part. So sue in every state. And we can talk about specifically the ACLU case in Michigan. That's a 7-figure lawsuit. So now you're talking about 50 states having seven-figure lawsuits. That would be a mountain of cash.
It is. A lot of these cases go straight down to crapper. I was derelict. I meant to bring some figures on a sex offense challenge that the law firm had invested into it, and they got nowhere, and how much that they're billable hours and how much out-of-pocket costs they're going to write off. But these challenges often go down the crapper with no success. And so you're looking at horrendous costs. That's the thing that keeps holding us back. Now, NARSL does have a small amount of cash on hand. We're trying to be so frugal because it's so hard to accumulate cash and make sure that we deploy to the best opportunities we can. But you're going to see probably more and more action as we get more and more cash available. But we don't have the treasury of the United States or the treasury of the whatever state behind us. We have a small group of donors who are extremely generous, who give us money, and they ask us to use it as best we can and as wisely as we can. And we're very conservative with deploying that cash. We don't just say, well, we got a few $1,000s. Let's just flop it down here, but plop some down there and throw a few things at the wall and hope it sticks.
Because
that would be...
Because from a strategic point of view, you definitely, like... You would want to have the most effective challenge go through so that you could then use that as a publicity campaign to try and draw in more funds. So you don't want to just like willy-nilly throw money around where it might just go down the toilet, like you just said.
Well, there are some people out there who would advocate that. They say doing something is better than doing nothing. Well, under the current management, we don't adhere to that. But see, our management can be changed like other organizations.
Right.
If you don't like NARSL management, present yourself through the process to be on the board, and you can get us old fogies off the board, and you can come in and run NARSL in a way that you see fit, because we don't have a closed system. And I'm not going to name the other organizations, but I can tell you, as far as I know, we are the only one of the so-called national organizations that do not have a closed process where outsiders can get in. I can speak for my state. Entirely. We have a completely open process. The states get into fights with another little tizzies and they form new organizations.
Right, right.
And in Mexico, the Liberty and Justice Coalition, all you have to do to be on the board of directors is to be a member of the coalition and be in good standing and not be under supervision. And if you can say that you agree with our mission statement of values, which is also can be changed by the board, and it can be voted on by the membership. But as long as you agree to that, you can plop yourself on the board and you can change the way we run the LJC. You don't need to go out and start a new organization. And I don't know what he's talking about, because NARSL is very welcoming of new blood. It's just that people don't want to put the hours into it and the time. The expectation of a board member, we just actually revised this at the strategic planning retreat we did earlier in January. But we're asking people to commit to 5 hours a week of volunteer time, plus to attend conferences at least twice a year out of their own pocket. And that's an awful lot to expect of people, to work 5 hours a week, to attend monthly board meetings, to serve on at least two committees, and to attend at least two major events at your own. Now we do fund the representation, like to ATSA and to the NACTL, but as far as attending the conference, the board members are on their own, just like everybody else.
Right. So, and let me just make the statement one more time: we are not NARSL. We are not. Registry Matters is not a publication of NARSL. It's not. It's affiliated only by friendship with NARSL. Because you and I both volunteer, they afford me the opportunity, they afford us the opportunity to use their marketing channels, so that you may have found this podcast through an email from NARSL. But that is just as a favor, and it doesn't represent an affiliation where you're just like friends, something along those lines. That is the affiliation with NARSL.
Maybe we ought to run that at each podcast.
I know. We've talked about that before, because this issue has come up before. And so we'll get Rick to record something kind of sexy sounding.
That this is an independent production, and that when I speak on behalf of NARSL, I make that clear. But otherwise, I'm speaking on behalf of me.
Yep. You are the Larry. All right. Well, you ready for some articles?
I hope so.
Cool. This first one comes from TheEagle.com, and judge dismisses a lawsuit alleging police school district contributed to students' suicide. This comes up with, where is this even out of? This is Napier North High School. Where did this happen? I forgot where it happened.
I think it was Illinois, isn't it?
Okay, could be Illinois. And a kid gets, he was a 16-year-old kid, and he allegedly had a naughty video of him and his girlfriend doing the nasty. And
a what?
The nasty, horizontal mambo, the slipping between the sheets. I mean, and yeah, I see all of the things that you tell me on the phone in private, they're coming out, but I'm avoiding saying them. And so he allegedly had a video on his phone. And when they said, hey, we need to talk to you and you might be in some trouble, he goes and finds the nearest tall bridge and he hurls himself off of the bridge and kills himself. And the ironic thing out of it is when they found the video, it was like all fuzzy. They couldn't make anything out. You could hear some things, but they couldn't actually make any prosecution out of him having anything like of child porn or anything of that nature. But ultimately, the judge says, hey, they were just doing their job. And what I captured, so it was Judge Andrea Wood, also wrote that while the interrogation tactics used by the deans and police were harsh and aggressive, they were nonetheless ordinary police interrogation tactics.
I found the article troubling, Andy. The parents not being there.
Right.
There's a longstanding tradition. I don't know if it's required, but certainly tradition that a police interrogation of a minor is always accompanied by a guardian or a parent. So I found that very, very troubling that this happened. The court not granting any relief. I didn't have enough time. Didn't even see the civil complaints. I don't know exactly what their complaints, but what I've referred back to, I said earlier, just because you don't like something doesn't mean there's a constitutional violation. You have to plead your case succinctly. And you have to tell the court exactly what was violated. And on the face of the pleading, according to the judge, although it was disturbing the outcome, that they didn't plead anything that they could prevail on at trial.
Right.
And I'm not in a position to say that. But as far as I know, Naperville is in Illinois.
Yes, it is. It says it's near Chicago.
Yeah. So this is very troubling that a 16-year-old lost his life. For all the adults out there listening to us, just remember, you did the naughty too when you were 16. If you could, can you imagine how you would have reacted if someone had called you to the office and threatened you with what they threatened the 16-year-old for you doing something that's biologically fairly normal? I think. Can you imagine what you would have been asking that teenager to carry the weight of that? I mean, he would have understood the sex offender registry, but what he would have understood, it's not a good thing. He would have understood that being prosecuted is not a good thing. And this would have been something that would have been way over anybody, 16-year-old, being able to process and handle. I can tell the people in Naperville, you ought to be ashamed of yourself.
Yep.
Even though the judge didn't find it, you ought to be evaluating how you're handling this, and you ought to make changes before, because it said they may appeal, said the attorney, Terry Eckel, said they may appeal to the Seventh Circuit. But even if they don't appeal, you ought to fix this. You ought not require another 16-year-old lose their life. This is tragic.
It is pretty sad that just by their pressure that they applied to them, they cracked the 16-year-old. And, I find a loose relationship that when we covered the article last week about the woman couldn't consent to sex with a police officer because she was in custody, I find this to be somewhat related, that when you put this child in custody who we have deemed to be inadequate, like they're not an adult, not inadequate, but they are not as mature. They're not, you know, they haven't been trained in these tactics of interrogation and stuff. They broke the kid just by bringing up that he might be in some level of trouble. And they cracked him to the point that he went and tossed himself off a bridge for being in that much trouble. They scared him that bad.
It was a whole, by all accounts, the article was an upstanding honors type student. But Naperville, this is sad that you would not be shocked. Even if the court wasn't shocked, the school board, the school administrators, you should be shocked, and you should make the changes to make sure this doesn't happen again. Why do you need a court to tell you what you need to do? It's like shackling a woman giving birth. Why do you need the state legislature to tell you that you can't do that?
Right.
You don't need the court to tell you this is wrong. You know this is wrong. Don't do it anymore. Make the changes so that another 16-year-old is never interrogated and threatened with a sex offender registry without a parent or guardian, without any legal counsel, and without any follow-up. I mean, at the very minimum, when he left the office, they should have asked him, was he okay?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
But how did they let him out of their sight too? That would be another, I mean, if they were going to interrogate him, then how did they let him out of his out of their sight?
Well, it's not clear in the story, but they probably told him, going back to class, you'll be hearing from us later. It's probably what they did. You know,
and he marched himself right to the door. He marched himself right to the door and went and tossed himself off a bridge, which is pretty gruesome. That would not be a good way to go.
Well, it was a park instructor, I think. But
that's right.
So, but this is tragic. And it says a little something about who we are in this country, particularly you people in Naperville. Are you going to do anything about this?
Yes.
You ought to be shocked.
But he was a sex offender, and we need to get those people off this earth.
So, well, that would be what some would say.
Yes. All right. And moving on to the article from the Daily Reporter, Changes in Sex Offender Registration Challenged. This one is kind of a neat article, if I recall right. And this is a challenge stating that sex offender registration law in 2006 and 2011 which were held unconstitutional in federal court. But I did want to ask you the specific question. It says down in the article, it says, the position of the Office of Attorney General Bill Schuette, perhaps, was to require each individual affected to file suit against the state. He claimed that Doe v. Snyder suit was not a class action, therefore it did not apply to all. Is that true?
That is correct.
So then...
Now.
Okay, all right, go ahead.
But the question is that the moral thing to do? It is legally the correct thing to do. Legally, they could give relief. I don't know. Last time I talked to the Michigan people, they hadn't even given those people relief yet from the registry.
Right.
They have by now. But morally, you know that when you put that hand on that Bible and you swore that you were going to uphold the law to the best of your ability, you remember that?
Yeah.
Well, the court, the highest court that you can air this thing to has told you, the U.S. Supreme Court said, the Sixth Circuit got it right. We don't want to review it. You know that what you're doing is wrong from a moral sense. But from a legal sense, they could say, well, bring it on. That's why the ACLU of Michigan is bringing their class action lawsuit to try to bring relief to everybody.
So the Doe v. Snyder, since it wasn't class action, it was just that individual or individuals, and it then only applies to them. Doesn't that then set the precedent for all the others to go, well, here's the documentation that says that this is the same thing. So does that just, yes, by default, doesn't that make it apply? Or you still have to litigate it?
Last podcast. Oh, you still got to litigate.
Oh, shit.
But it's gonna be a much faster litigation because the precedent's already set. And the Sixth Circuit's not likely to reverse itself. One panel won't reverse another panel's work. So even if the state appealed again on the same issues, if they're brought in class action, another three-judge panel is not going to undo the work of the three-judge panel that's decided this. So therefore, the same outcome is coming. So what gets to happen is the people that pride themselves on being fiscally responsible conservatives, low-government people, and I criticized them last week on the podcast, those people are driving up the cost to defend this indefensible registry in Michigan rather than changing the law. So you got an attorney general who's fighting tooth and nail each individual, and the state's going to pay out a whole bunch more money in legal fees. The ACLU is going to be funded better and better for the foreseeable future when you could just do the right thing. But they're not going to do the right thing because they're just not going to.
But what about, how does this apply to they're going to do the thing until they're told to stop? Haven't they then been told to stop?
Well, they were told to stop against those individuals.
Just those individuals. So then we still have to then fight this individually. So the other 40,000, I'm not trying to exclude the ACLU class action challenge, but then the 40,000 people of Michigan have to then go hire an attorney and bring this challenge to gum up the legal system to that degree?
Well, I mean, that's why we have class actions. Everybody misunderstands class actions. Some actions are not well suited for class certification. Some are. This is one where it's already got appellate precedent driving the train. And the issues that the people that are impacted would be similar, and judicial economy would be achieved by class action. So this would be one where it should be okay, and it should not be too difficult to get the class certified, which you have to. You don't just stamp. Everybody thinks, well, you got to get a red rubber stamp, or you'll put class action, and you go in and they make. Well, that doesn't make a class action. What makes a class action is having commonality of claims and a number of factors that a court evaluates whether this law firm is capable of staying in communication and adequately representing the class if they were certified. And the ACLU would probably meet that criteria. They would be deemed as capable of representing the interest of the class, and they would probably certify the class. But as a general rule, conservatives rail against class actions. They tend to not want them. They try to do everything they can to diminish class action certifications, because like when disputes with employers, they want the individual to have to bring the case because they know it's much more prohibitive for an individual. If you get wronged for a couple $100 or $500 at your job, it's a lot harder for you to bring an individual action than it is for a group of people that has the same beef about whatever the claim may be. So conservatives generally don't like class actions.
Right.
Unless it's something that they're trying to achieve for themselves.
of course.
They typically don't like class actions because it makes it more efficient for people to use the justice system. And this, like I say, in my view, this will probably be certified. I'm not staying on top of what's going on in Michigan, but I know that the ACLU is going to file a class action and file an action and seek class certification. And they're going to try to provide this relief to everybody. It's just a matter of time. But see, that matter of time could be the death of an offender.
Sure.
that's the sad thing about this is people say, well, it's only one extra day. But when I talk about getting you out of jail, defense attorneys, we want our clients out of jail as fast as we can get them out of jail. Well, the one day, if you had been in New Mexico prison on February 28th, 1980, and you got released, you wouldn't have been in the deadliest prison riot on February 29th, 1980 that took the lives of 33 inmates.
Right. Yeah, sure. And, or that could be a missed job opportunity. It could be a missed relationship. It could be a missed housing opportunity. It could be a missed event at your kid's school.
Or it could be a projectile coming through your window by somebody who finds you on the registry.
Correct. Yeah. All of the above.
So all this stubbornness on behalf of the state of Michigan is putting people in danger, causing people untold suffering for what? I mean, I can't speak to what his motivations are. I can speculate. Probably because he thinks that the public's behind him. He probably thinks he gets going to get more votes and more support, regardless about the cost and about the human cost and the monetary cost, because that's all hidden from the taxpayers. I mean, if you have a state as large as Michigan that's spending billions and billions of dollars, a few million dollars in legal fees really is not noticeable. So,
well, that's good time.
Listeners in Michigan, you listeners in Michigan, just remember you elected this attorney general.
And you could unelect him. Right.
Well, at some point, I don't know what his cycle is, but what he said made him happy at the time they voted for him.
And then moving on to an article from thecolumbiapaper.com, or I guess it's just columbiapaper.com. This article is titled "Officials Question Impact of Sex Offender Registry," and there is some significant debate going back and forth between. Now, let me just like tell you this: if you end up reading this article, one person that they spoke to is Scott Thomas, and the other individual they spoke to was a woman with the last name of Scott. Oh, God, where to go? Anyway, it's a little bit confusing because, you know, they'll say Scott this, Scott that, and you're like, wait, which one said it? But isn't this whole – what they're talking about in the article is about a due process violation. Although courts determine guilt, administrators determine which level someone found guilty of a sex offense is assigned. And there are problems with process of assigning levels, said Ian Crimmins, an assistant public defender for Columbia County. Decisions made by administrators need less proof than those made in law courts. Furthermore, administrative decisions are hard to overturn at a legal level. All right. What I needed to read that to remind me that your due process happens when you are in the court system, but when you get leveled, well, I think we've talked about, it is not always the same kind of due process system. It's not by your peers. It could be based on a whole bunch of factors that do or don't apply. And they even said in the article, some job applications no longer ask, have you ever been convicted of a crime? However, in an interview, someone was asked, are you on any registry? That's something you just said a few minutes ago. So this is an interesting article where people are pushing back on the effectiveness of the registry as a whole.
Well, there's a lot in this article because leveling systems work differently in states. Some are purely offense-based. So the legislators themselves have said if you did this particular offense, it's level one or tier one. And some states have a risk-based system where they go through a process. And New York actually has that risk-based system, so your leveling is done in a different process in New York, but I do think it goes through a judicial process. If I remember right, we've had this on a previous podcast. If you get leveled wrong, there should be a due process for you to argue that in the states where it's based on risk. If it's based on the offense, it becomes more difficult, because unless you have an out-of-state offense, it's pretty straightforward.
Right.
If the legislature said these are level one, these are level two, these are level three, that's what they are.
Yes.
But what do you do when you have an out-of-stater? Because then they have to do some kind of translation, which is what we've talked about on the situation in North Carolina with the recent case that Paul Dubling won, the Meredith case.
Okay.
But what are we trying to answer first on all this plethora of different things in here? Because your level can have a lot of impact on what restrictions you have imposed on you, what reporting requirements you have, how long you would have to register. I mean, level can be very important in some jurisdictions.
Certainly. And the first paragraph of the article was what I should have read at the beginning. It says, ways to reduce the chance of ex-convicts returning to crime after completing their sentences, including helping them get secure housing, secure income, helpful education, and counseling. Scott Thomas, Division Director of the Mental Health Association of Columbia Green Counties, told a meeting of Reentry at Columbia January 9th. That's what the premise of the article is, in that all of the disabilities and restraints, I think is probably just the best way to put it, of all the registry things prevent many people from having secure housing, income, and all that stuff. So then the article goes on to discuss all the different impact that the registry does have on people trying to not go back to prison for having to commit a crime.
Well, yes. And like I say, the restrictions go up in those states, like our friends in Arkansas, we're going to talk about later in the podcast. If you're level three and four, you have residency restrictions, or if you're level one and two, you don't.
Mm-hmm.
And Arkansas assigns you a risk process of going through their risk assessment board in Pine Bluff. And it's a far from perfect process, but there is a process, and it is appealable. But your restrictions go up if they get it wrong.
Right.
And if you're level one in Arkansas, the last time I checked, they're not even visible on the internet.
Okay.
Now the sheriffs in some instances have created their own websites outside of the state central repository, and have put people on even that are not displayed by the state central registry, which is another tragedy that needs to be litigated. Haven't been able to do so because we don't have no money.
Yeah, sure.
Or not enough money.
I don't know how practical it is. There's even a sentence in it that says, in jail, guys who went to the sex offender workshop, everybody knew who they were. That's a form of stigma and marginalization. But everybody goes to some kind of class. I don't know how you, you're going to be in class with someone else, so they're going to know, and they're going to spread the word, perhaps. It's like, I don't know how you keep people from being identified, marked for the various kinds of classes or whatever that they go into, to remove that whole thing of some kind of stigma. And marginalization. I don't know how to practically pull that one off.
It's a tough one, because although I've never done prison time, I know that prisons have networks that you would not believe in terms of their ability to get information about people.
Certainly. I mean, you just talk to your family at home, and they look people up on the internet and find out what your crime was. I mean, that's not rocket science.
They give people brand new identities and put them on interstate compact in other state prisons when they have safety issues. And magically, within a short period of time, the people in the new state figure out who they
sure.
are.
Sure. And
I don't know how to do
well, then there are connections inside like the orderly room and whatnot, you know, or wherever, you know, whatever your terms are for the people that work in the personnel, whatever you want to call it, the, you know, people that work in the records office, maybe even as orderlies, they get kind of cozy with the staff in there, and they'll find out who people are. They get rosters. Oh. I know, right? So
inmates get cozy with staff.
Yes, I know it happens. It's hard to believe, right?
Oh, that is shocking.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, that's pretty much all I got.
Oh, that is shocking to think that humans be attracted to one and get close. That's kind of how they have sex when they're in custody sometimes, which I was surprised we didn't. I was expecting you to give me two or three hate emails about what I said last week about that.
Nope, nothing came in about that. We got articles about all kinds of other things. And
I was expecting a hate mail about that, because I don't believe. Say, let me just take this time to clarify. You know, that wasn't on the plan for tonight. I'm not saying that when someone is in your custody and control, whether they be in police custody or any type of place where you have control, I'm not saying that it's okay. There are times when you should bow out of having sex. What I am saying is just because they're in within your control of some type, that doesn't make it rape. Rape is a horrible crime where a person has been physically violated against their will. To me, a rape victim would be outraged by calling something rape that was not rape. Maybe I'm wrong, but I know that I would be if I had had someone physically invade my body with whatever they inserted in me, and then someone who started smooching on each other because they were working together. In a prison unit where someone happened to be working there, and they found each other attractive. To call that rape,
right,
to me is absurd.
Yeah.
It is inappropriate. The person should be taken out of the prison setting. They can't have their eyes on the candy. But it's like the Taylor Bonkel up in Connecticut, where the 18-year-old stalked her and went home with the teacher.
Yep, yep, yep.
Who was like 24 or whatever age she was.
Yep.
That was not rape. That was a case where it was an error in judgment that could have been handled administratively, where they could have called her in and said, well, effective next week, your paycheck will be sent to Bel Air Elementary. If you'd like to continue to get paid by the school district, you'll show up over there. And you won't say anything about the transfer. You apparently cannot keep your eyes off, your hands off of these young men, and that's not appropriate in this setting, and therefore we're going to remove that temptation from you. But she did not commit rape. She had an affair that was inappropriate. It should not have involved prosecution. It is not rape.
Right. I agree with you. I agree, you know, and it's a distinction in terms specifically. I don't think the dude feels bad about the situation. He got to I don't want to use the crude terms. He had a relationship with a pretty good looking woman. And so she had a relationship with a pretty good looking dude. Right. So like, you know, the inappropriate part becomes where she was a teacher, but she wasn't even his teacher. Right.
Right. But we don't want that going on. But like I say, that's not rape.
Right. I agree. Cause they were both consenting adults.
It was a lapse in judgment.
Right. Right.
And if a police officer puts a gun to your head and says, this thing, I'm going to play Russian roulette with you, that would be rape. That would definitely be rape. But if it's shy of that, and I can't draw the magic line of where it is, but consensual sex is not rape between adults. Now, I'll make sure I put that in there. I'm talking about adults. I'm not talking about a 13, 14-year-old.
Yeah.
I'm talking about if a 13, 14-year-old and a 40-year-old or 30-year-old person, that's not the same comparison. But when we talk about adults, you can't call rape something. And that's what New York, I believe it was stories out of New York, they're going to call anything where a person is in any type of custody, and expanded custody, not just to be in a jail facility, but at any type where they're in a detained situation, they're going to call that rape. I just don't see it that way. But I expected to get tons of criticism for that one.
Probably. All right.
But I didn't.
Well, now that you've doubled down on it, so maybe it'll come in this time. I picked up.
So now we're going to the 50th state.
Yes, we are going. Unless it's the 52nd state, but that's another conversation. This article is from the Registry Report, and it is about homeless. The title of it is Hawaii's Homeless Registrants. And it says legislators in Hawaii are considering a bill that would make it illegal for any person on the sexual offense registry to reside within 1,000 feet of any school, childcare facility, or playground or park. And there's a funny little, I shouldn't say funny, but, you know, funny in a sad kind of way. But if you draw a 1,000-foot circle around every park, school, playground, daycare facility, blah, 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 in the state to create a safety zone, you will be effectively driving them into the sea or back to prison. You know, Hawaii's not really a big place, but they still have parks. And probably, you know, like half of Hawaii, I'm just going to guess, is probably a state park because of, you know, just being a really picturesque place, and it's probably protected and state parkland. Yeah, you might end up making almost the entire state an unlivable place. But the article cites a whole bunch of statistics. I'm just going to assume that the author has his stats right, that Hawaii's criminal population or crimes compared to the rest of the United States, it's about half of what the other states have, the national average. So this seems to be just a solution in search of a problem, ultimately. Why, like, you know, we have a homeless problem in the United States as it is, and this is just going to make people have a really severe homeless problem.
Well, it does seem to be a solution in search of a problem, because the article says, despite the fact that news media claims that 28 of Hawaii's sex registrants were living in parts, the truth of the matter is all those registrants were required to give law enforcement an address, and relative, and it's relatively common for registrants to designate a park. Hawaii is one of our more expensive states.
Right.
It receives a lot of tourism dollars, and things tend to be expensive because the import, the travel distance of things have to go to be. Electricity rates are high. Their housing cost is high. Everything has to be imported practically from the mainland. And it's an expensive place to live. And homelessness has been, for all of my adult life, I've been aware of homelessness, that it's been a problem in Hawaii. So I think if you compound that with being on the registry, what detriment it does in the rest of the country, why would it be any less detrimental in Hawaii? So I would imagine that you would have encampments of people on the registry that can't find any place to live and can't be employed. But what are they supposed to do?
I wonder this question all the time. I wonder that all the time. What ultimately do you want people to do?
You know, this is one of those things where we're so detached from it, from the mainland here. It's like, if Colorado needed a hand, I could jet up there in 8 hours.
Right.
Could fly even faster. But the cost of getting to Hawaii and the time, you know, I certainly can't drive. It's like it's difficult to fight back in that situation. We have to hope that rational saneness prevails, and that at least the fact they're discussing this about it might be a solution in search of a problem may be able to deter them from putting these restrictions in place that make people feel good but actually make the problem worse.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatters at your treatment class, about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible. This article comes from The Island Now. And this article is titled, Child Victims Act Passes, Extending Opportunities for Survivors to File Charges. They say that the victims' advocates have been trying for more than a decade to bring this bill to fruition, which would be one thing that we could like kind of circle back around on, how hard it is to get legislation to pass. This seems like it would be wickedly popular, but it still took a decade for it to get through. But the law allows survivors to file criminal charges until age 28 and civil charges until age 55. And of people that are, you know, if you're 15 years old and your stepdad does some naughty things to you, you have until you're 55 to file a civil claim against him. I see how this got where it is. I'm kind of surprised it took 10 years. The one thing that I want you to speak to is that, as soon as I can find it, it said the Republican-held Senate spent years successfully blocking legislation like the Child Victims Act and the Reproductive Health Act, which passed January 22nd and codifies Roe versus Wade abortion provisions in state law. So it was Republicans that helped prevent this from getting there. And now I think New York just voted in all Democrats, and that's how the legislation went through.
Well, I've never said that the Democrats were the cure-all, end-all. And when it comes down to victims' advocates, the Democrats are going to be on the wrong side. They're going to side with the victims' advocates. And Republicans often do also. I don't know the politics of New York well enough to know, but I do know that they got the assembly back. But you see, the vote was unanimous in the Senate, so that would include Democrats and Republicans, 130-3 in the House. but that doesn't tell the whole story. And I always tell people, you can't look at these, because if it gets to the floor, you can't vote against this stuff. You're going to get killed,
right,
in your next election campaign. You have to look at what the committees change. When majority party changes, then the ratio, the control of the committees, who chairs them, and the ratios go in favor of the majority party. So a lot of things get bottled up in committee that, if they were ever put on the floor, would pass. I mean, countless things would pass on the floor if they could ever get to the floor, and that's just the way it is. And a person listening out there doesn't understand the process. They would say, well, why doesn't everything go directly to the floor? Well, because it can't. Right now, we're over 1,000, or right at 1,000 bills in our legislature for a 60-day session. And we still got to the 15th before the deadline to introduce cuts off.
Right.
It would not be possible to vet that many pieces of legislation by the entire body. So the committees are where the work is done. they try to align committees if they're doing it consistent with any type of system with what the member desires to their expertise in life and what they're interested in. And then seniority has a play in it. But the majority party controls the calendar, controls the chairs, chairmanships, the chairpersonships, and the ratios of the committees. And so what was bottled up in committee has now gotten out of committee. The victims' advocates have gotten better and better organized. They started with relatively, like a few years ago, we only just had one that would show up here at our Capitol. It was easy to marginalize, and if that's probably not the best choice of word, but it was easier for us to overcome what one says. Now they're showing up in much greater numbers. They're parading through several people saying how bad, you know, this happened to me 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. I've heard as much as 40 years ago, people come to the Capitol and tell stories about things. I don't know if they're true. I don't know if they're not true. What I do know is they can't get a fair trial. If someone's charged with these old offenses, they cannot get a fair trial. It has nothing to do with me not caring about whether that happened to you or not. Maybe it did. Maybe it didn't. I know that you want that person to get a fair trial. You should want that person to get a fair trial. I don't know that you do want, but you should want that person to get a fair trial, because the next person who's accused of something they didn't do could be you. And that's why you want that person to get a fair trial.
Right.
And you can't get a fair trial decades later.
There's a block in the article. It says the justice system turns its back on victims in the state of New York, and today that's going to change, said Marcy Hamilton, CEO of Child USA. And for those that don't remember or didn't watch it, Marcy Hamilton is the one that debated Emily Horowitz in New York. That video came out about a year ago. Highly recommend it. Emily pretty much wrecked Marcy Hamilton on everything that she was trying to say, that like they don't age out. The recidivism rate, all these things. Emily had all of her stats in place and debated her very well. And Marcy was just kind of dumbfounded by the level of support that Emily had, and just outstanding. Marcy is not one of our friends. That is for damn sure.
Oh, now, Andy, I can't believe you say that. You know that the victims' advocates, and we're going to work hand in hand and sing kumbaya, and we're going to be on the same page someday. I don't know why you don't understand that.
Yeah. All right, then. Hey, let's move on. we might actually need to talk about getting people tinfoil hats and all these things, because this one's disturbing me specifically. And this is from The Appeal, and it's prisons across the U.S. are quietly building databases of incarcerated people's voice prints. They say in the article that there are states where you will have like a script that you will read, and they will record your voice print. And then from that point forward, they know exactly who you are. And that means if you are then not incarcerated and you speak to someone inside the prison system, now they have your voice print. This, to a certain degree, makes anybody on the outside, your friends, family, whatever that you may be talking to, that their voices are now getting fingerprinted, giving the officials, law enforcement apparatus, the information that your mom is also talking to these other people in prison, and it, to a certain degree, criminalizes her being a friend of felons. This is not cool. You already have to fill out paperwork to approve phones. At least I know in my state they do, maybe not in all of them. So they already kind of sort of know who you are talking to when you pick up that phone. But now they're making it to the point where you will say, I guess I just won't call my family anymore.
I guess that's where we're headed with this, because technology is always hard to turn back. Technology gets way ahead of civil liberties, and before anybody thinks about the civil ramifications to our liberties, it's become ingrained, and there's an industrial complex sprung up. And you look at that list of states that are already doing this.
Yeah.
Even yours is on the list. Yep. It's hard because when you try to make a public stand against this, institutional security, oh, we got to keep the institutions safe. Too much contraband coming in. Oh, and it's hard to get public support for jail administrators are given. It's like our guest last week that said that the Border Patrol says they need that. Therefore, really? You're ready to just because law enforcement says they need something, you're ready to just, okay, well, sure, that's exactly what you need. I'm a little more skeptical of the prison's need for this, but I don't know what we can do about it.
Yeah, I think this one would be really hard. I mean, you know, this isn't terribly different than having all of the cameras on every street corner everywhere, just watching all your movements. Not necessarily to watch your movements, but to look for traffic congestion or things, you know, to be able to have some sort of record if there's a crime, not to watch people. But in effect, you end up watching all the people because you have the data. Yeah, this one really bothers me from a civil liberties point of view, that you're now effectively making it significantly harder for people to have conversations with their families. And you are, in effect, kind of criminalizing those people for having conversations with you on the inside. This one really bothers me.
I wonder why Securus, which is one of the big companies, I wonder why they didn't want to respond to a request for comment.
I know that one of the friends of the podcast, Josh, who does the Decarceration Nation podcast, he went over and he has actually like called them out in a massive way on Twitter. And I don't know to what degree he's had, but I want to say he's even had interviews with them. He's spoken to them on the phone. I'd have to get more details. He's been somewhat effective at getting in touch with them to some degree, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, the prison says that the problem that they're having with the current system is that people are using other people's pins. And even though they think they know who's on the phone, they really don't, because if they use someone else's pin, then it's not the person that the call is registered to. That's their justification.
Yeah, I mean, final paragraph. And they try really hard to figure out, you know, if your mom's forwarding the phone to your brother, whatever, because they've made it so hard for you to make phone calls, like make it easier to make phone calls. You already have caller ID. Like, you have an idea who's on the other end of the phone. I mean, like, I have stuff on my phone that tells me who's calling when they're calling, and I don't necessarily have them in my contact. You can't tell me that with the law enforcement apparatus that they don't already know who you're calling. Yes, it could be spoofed. But those are probably the people, you know, like the massive drug dealer cartel types already. You're probably already watching them more, but just some Joe Schmo. They're just trying to call mom to get some money put on their books.
So, well, and I get tickled when I hear prison officials say, well, if they weren't up to no good, they wouldn't mind going to the monitored system. Well, that's crazy, because the system is not only monitored, it's very expensive to make calls, particularly if the receiving phone number is outside the area code of the originating number. Even so much just the area code, but what they used to call the local access transport area, if it's outside the LATA. You can be in the same area code, but be outside the lot, and it's long distance. So people end up getting stuck with toll charges. And who would want to pay $5, $6, $8, $10, $12, $15 a phone call? And they say, well, why would they want a cell phone? Because they don't want to pay that ripoff money. They don't have it. That's why. Well, this is a long article, but there's a number of states, the large states, Texas saying it's required. New York says it has 92% of its population enrolled in it.
Yeah.
You know, Texas, Arkansas,
yep,
Florida. So this is the wave of the future.
No doubt. Good times, man. Good times. This one's a little bit interesting. I don't know what SLED is. This one's coming from South Carolina, abcnews4.com. SLED sends sex offender alerts. Do you get them? This is a total fear-mongering article. I don't know what SLED, I don't know that they ever said what SLED stands for. But it's like sex offender level emergency distribution, whatever it stands for. But it's funny. So there are 10,000 people roughly on the sex offender registry in South Carolina. And they got some officer to cop to say how challenging it is for him to go out and monitor. It says the state mandates that we check, do one field check a year minimum to anybody on the registry. We also have to check them anytime they move or change residency. We have to check them within about 30 days. And his little county, there's 900 in his county. So he has to do 75 home visits per month in his county. And I'm like, stop doing them. But they're trying to promote a notification system where other states in Louisiana, 84,000 people know right away when a sex offender moves in. And in Arkansas, 8,500 have signed up, but only a few hundred people, 1,300 people have signed up in South Carolina. So it's like, okay. And Just to backtrack, I was speaking to one of our listeners before the show, and this is relevant. He says, well, don't you have a right to know when someone moves in next door that's on the registry?
I don't know where such right would come from. What would give you the right to know who moves in next door to you?
I don't know. Can you fabricate an idea of why someone would have the right to know?
Well, this has been an unchallenged assertion that has been behind the registry. I have a right to know. No, you have no right to know who lives next to you. Where does that right enshrine that you have the right to know? I thought in America you had the right to privacy. Where the hell do you get the idea you have the right to know?
Right.
But we've never challenged that. I'm the only one I know that'll say. Our advocates, when they say, well, don't I have a right to know? I would say, no, ma'am, you actually don't have a right to know. Arguably, you might have a right to know if the person is still paying their debt to society. For example, if they're parole supervision, if they're under community control or house arrest or something, you might could argue that you would have a right to know. But when they've paid their debt to society, you have no such right to know.
Right.
But we always say, yes, you have a right to know. No, you actually don't. You have the right to go down to the tax assessor's office and see who owns the property. Those are public records. But who lives in the house? Why don't you try knocking at the door and telling people you're taking the roll on who lives there that you have a right to know and find out what happens to you? Do that for the rest of the day, all weekend, and tell me what happens to you.
Oh, SLED stands for State Law Enforcement Division.
Yeah. I was going to tell you when I got a moment. But yeah, I found that out by Googling it when I read the article.
Oh, it's at the very bottom of the article. If you want to see the most up-to-date list of sex offenders living or working in your area, check out the South Carolina Sex Offender Registry on the SLED State Law Enforcement website. Click here. So yeah, this is an article about some officer just bitching that he has to check 75 people a month. So sign up to get notifications to make his job easier. Good times.
Well, I love that right to know. The Registry Matters podcast, at least half the team doesn't think you have a right to know, and I would challenge you to show me where you have the right to know. I mean, you have the right to know in the sense that they've passed a statute that says you have a right to know, but you don't have any constitutional right to know. This is an invented right that you have invented and got codified, but there's no right to know where someone who's lived in a particular dwelling. It's none of your damn business, in fact.
Right. The final article of the night is going to be, I got it through Florida Action Committee, but you can probably find it from some different places. I will have a second link in there in the show notes from Arkansas Online. But we spoke, I'm pretty sure it was last week, if not, it was the week before, that Arkansas was trying to introduce, they were introducing a bill that would make, they would criminalize Halloween for certain offenders. But as it turns out, that Representative Andrew Collins showed up informed and asked some various questions if she was aware of studies that showed zero increase in sex offender crimes on Halloweens, and that when I said she, it was Rebecca Petty, and she said, I do not have the answer. Then she called on Arkansas Crime Information Center Administrator Brad Cozart to answer and the question on the committee, and Cozart said he did not have any hard data specific to Halloween crimes by registered offenders. And maybe the bill has been shut down. So we have effectively one person has shut down this bill from getting very far.
Well, it got quite a ways. It passed the Arkansas Senate. It was a Senate bill. I believe it was Senate Bill 10. But it passed the Senate with flying colors, 29-1, I believe, or unanimously. But then it goes to the House, and it gets killed in committee. And so kudos to Arkansas people. Arkansas time after time, AT&T, I believe it is. So kudos to Arkansas time after time. I'm a little unclear since I've been in this arena for a long time, but the terminology in the Arkansas Democrat Gazette report said that the vote was expunged. And I've been in legislating and in this arena for a long time. I've never heard that as a terminology. So I don't know particularly what that means in terms of resuscitation of this bad proposal. When something is killed in committee, typically it can be brought back to life and resurrected. It can be improved. Now, this one, I was itching for a fight, although I said last week I didn't think it was going to be a slam dunk. But it looked like it was vague enough that a good void for vagueness challenge could be made. And actually, one of the attorneys, if you look at the Gazette article, apparently brought that issue up and said that there was the issue of it being too vague. So it may be that they tabled it temporarily and I'm going to use the term table, which I'm most familiar with, when something can't move forward because it's structurally defective. What we do here in many states is we table it, and then they work on it, and then they bring it back to life by a motion to remove it from the table and put back in active consideration. So I don't know exactly if this is the same process in Arkansas, but it'd be nice to have an Arkansan let us know. And boy, do they love it when you call them Arkansas. It'd be nice to find out if this is dead for the year. But it looked like from the article in the paper that it could be resurrected, in which case you need to be constantly on guard, watching what's going on, and be ready to pounce if they try to resurrect this horrible bill. But it is an example of a few people making a difference. This thing sailed through the Senate, and then it got in trouble in the House. There were cooler heads prevailed, and at least it's been temporarily, if not permanently, derailed for this session. But as I've said on so many podcasts before, these people don't give up. They come back, and they come back again and again. We just talked about it earlier for 10 years worth.
Yeah, yeah. And but the thing that I really wanted you to latch onto is, as being one of those people that will go do these derailments, that as far as the article says, one person, maybe two people, maybe one of our constituents brought that that politician brought him the statistics and said, hey, this is stupid because of XYZ. And he was then able to go into the committee and say, hey, let me ask you these couple questions. And that shut the whole thing down just by that, what seems to be pretty low level, easy level of informing a politician of how these things are just bad ideas.
Well, it does seem easy. It actually is not that easy. It's not impossible. But first of all, the person had to have proximity to Little Rock. They had to be reasonably intelligent and coherent and be able to communicate. You don't get the best respect if you come in with screws and bolts and with your pants hanging down to your showing off your butt crack and looking disrespectful for the environment you're in. So you have to be able to comport yourself in a professional, dignified manner. You have to be able to pursue the key person, knowing who the key person is to talk to. And you have to analyze how politically exposed that person might be. They might be willing to raise these questions. You have to latch onto that person and get them informed enough. And it requires relationships and respect. So there's a little bit of work into it. But yes, with a modest amount of work, one person can make a lot of difference. So I don't want to minimize it. It took a lot of effort, but it's something that more people could do if they set their mind to it. But it would require commitment and understanding the process and being respectful of the process. Don't go into the House and be rude, disrespectful. Don't go in dressed like a bum. Expect to gain any respect. I mean, dress the part. I see too many people come in the Capitol that look like that. That, I mean, nobody's going to take them seriously, but they come in and they say their piece, and the decisions are made after they've had their piece to say. But this is an example of a modest amount of work paying a dividend.
And yeah, but I didn't want to minimize it, but I didn't also want to, like, you know, it's not like you had to climb Mount Everest. There is a process, but it is a teachable process, and it's not rocket science making some relationships, you know, following, being respectful and all that stuff. But I didn't want to minimize it, but I also didn't want to, like, make it seem like it is, you know, moving a mountain either. It's something that our people could do more regularly is really what I'm trying to get at.
Our people could do that. And they did do that. And our people could do more of that. But the processes are complicated enough to where oftentimes you end up spending a day. And then a bill gets rolled over to another day because the congestion on the calendar, and it's difficult work.
Right.
I mean, but it's not rocket science. I suspect that a lot of people out there could do it if they set their mind about and wanted to learn the process.
Well, all right then. I think we have covered all the things. Have we covered all the things?
Well, I think we have, but we got to get this podcast to double this year. Remember, wasn't that our goal?
I was actually trying to go tenfold, but double would be just fine. I didn't know if I wanted to try and commit to a tenfold increase.
Well, how are we going to do that? What would be the way to help it do that?
I need specifically Jeff to go out there and share this with and get 10 people to listen to it. And then also I need you, Larry, to get 10 people to listen to it. And I'm going to get 10 people to listen to it. If we could get everybody that listens to this to get 10 more people to listen to it, then we would have a tenfold increase. And that would be easy peasy. But you would find it by going to the website at registrymatters.co, not com, but registrymatters.co. You can find it on your podcast app of choice all over the interwebs. You can ask your smart home speaker how to find it. And so there's that. You can email us at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And your favorite, Larry, you could call in and leave a voicemail message at 747-227-4477. And you can find us. Of course, the best way to support the podcast is over at Patreon. So visit us at patreon.com/registrymatters. And iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, YouTube, we're in all the places. That's all I got.
Well, and no one called us this week, and I love voice messages. If there were some phone calls.
There were some phone calls. One of them was way too long, and one of them the quality wasn't good enough for me to use.
Oh. Well,
we have a person that is very much anti-polygraph and wants to talk all about it.
Well, that should be something you would love.
I would, but like every third word he broke up and couldn't understand, so I had to let it go.
Then, anti-polygrapher, you better call in again and make sure you have a solid connection.
I will do that. I will reach out to him, and cause we had some debate back and forth, some conversation back and forth, not debate about it. But yeah. So, yep, that's all we got. And Larry, as always, thank you very much for joining me, and we look forward to it in the near future.
Thanks, Aiden. I hope you invite me back.
I will invite you back, most likely. Take care, Larry.
Good night.